Mrs. Huckabee insisted we go to the principal's office to give him a chance to solve the problem. She assured us that he would be fair. Principal Matthews began to speak in his slow, plodding way, wearing his usual nervous smile. It was apparent he only wanted to stop us from making the call. I was in no mood to have him tell me I was imagining things, not with my leg aching and the steel flash of that switchblade knife fresh in my mind. Either you give us some protection so we can function without getting killed, or we go home. I heard the words come out of my mouth, but I could hardly believe it was me speaking. My knees were shaking. It was the first time in my life I had ever stood up to any adult, certainly to any white adult. But I was on the edge, ready to take the risk, because how could anything the adults might do to me be worse than the abuse I was already enduring? "Wait here," the principal said, his tone of voice leaving no doubt he was annoyed with us. Shortly afterward, we saw the brass approaching. General Klinger and Colonel McDaniel of the Arkansas National Guard and a third military man I did not recognize. Klinger pointed to the two of us, most especially to me, and said, "You'll sit over there where I can look you in the face." Right away, I didn't like him, but I was ready to deal with him. The rest of our group was summoned to the office. Everyone was vocal about the severity of the attacks during the morning. Each one had a story about how the physical abuse had increased significantly. We told Klinger that his men were not protecting us, that they stood by, socializing and flirting while we were being beaten within an inch of our lives. "Those guards are turning their backs to attacks on us, and we demand you do something about it," I insisted. Klinger didn't deny the charges. He explained that his men had to live in the community. "We just want to keep living, period," I said.
"Don't talk directly to the guards. Go to the office and report incidents," we were told.
I said, "With all due respect, sir, how can we run to the office every time we want help? Somebody could be beating one of us at the far end of the hall, and we'd have to wait until they finished and let us up so we could come here to report it." I felt something inside me change that day. I felt a new will to live rise up in me. I knew I wasn't just going to roll over and die. I could take care of myself and speak up to white folks, even if my mother and father sometimes feared doing so. I discovered I had infinitely more guts than I had started the school year with. I had no choice. It was my life I was dickering for. I knew that Klinger didn't care about our welfare, not even a tiny bit.
"Young lady," Klinger said, eyeballing me, "you are turning our words. I didn't say..."
But I cut him off. "My friends and I will leave school if we don't get adequate protection. It's as simple as that," I told him. The others were obviously as angry as I was as they chimed in with their complaints. They voiced their agreement that something had to be done immediately.
"You'll have bodyguards."
Klinger spoke with a definite edge to his voice. He summoned another soldier and told him to select 18 men while we waited there. Those Arkansas guardsmen were the biggest, dumbest, most disheveled hayseeds I'd ever seen. They looked as if they had slept in their rumpled uniforms. We stood there not believing our eyes, dumbfounded by the sight of them. "These clods will trip over their own shoelaces," I whispered to Minnie Jean. "Or worse yet, get us in some dark corner and beat the living daylights out of us," she replied. After about 15 minutes, we moved out, or in their case, shuffled out. It was a sight to behold.
There we were, followed by an absurd wall of not-so-mighty military green trailing us, like a ridiculous wagging tail. We found ourselves laughing aloud, and the white students were laughing with us. For just one moment, we all realized the ridiculous situation we were caught up in. Four of us went to our usual table in the cafeteria. The guards took up their posts, leaning against a nearby wall. When I got up to get in line for a sandwich, they fell over each other trying to see where I was going and which of them would follow me. Two stood in line with me, arms folded, tummies out, and shoulders rounded. Each time one of us rose to get anything, two of those clowns stumbled up to follow. It was a comedy of errors. As we moved through the halls in our oddball group, I saw, just a few feet away, the boy who had pulled the knife on me earlier. The momentary terror I felt reminded me our situation wasn't funny after all. I miss Danny. That was another feeling taking me over. Rumor had it that the 101st waited at Camp Robinson, just outside Little Rock. But I knew that even if he came back again and again, there would come the day when he would be gone for good. Still, I was overjoyed when on Thursday we once again had our 101st bodyguards. Maybe they were forced to come back because the Morning Gazette had reported the story of Terry and Jeff being kicked while Arkansas National Guardsmen looked on. As we arrived at school that morning, I noticed right away that there was a different kind of tension, as though everyone was waiting for something awful to happen, only we didn't know what. We had heard rumors of a planned student protest. I could see groups of students standing in the halls instead of in class, where they would normally have been. Just before first period, more students began walking out of classes. Rumors about a big event reverberated throughout the school. I could see and feel a new level of restlessness and a deepening sense of hostility. I was on edge, waiting for disaster any moment, like dynamite or a group attack or I didn't know what. "They're hanging a nigger, just like we're gonna hang you," someone muttered. That's when I learned that some of those who walked out had assembled at the vacant lot at 16th and Park, across from the school, where they hanged and burned a straw figure. That demonstration set the tone of the day. Belligerent student protests were firing up the already hostile attitude inside the school. Danny broke the rules by coming closer and talking to me, warning that we had to stay alert no matter what. Near the end of the day, I was walking down a dimly lit hallway, with Danny following, when I spotted a boy coming directly toward me on a collision course. I tried to move aside, but he moved with me. I didn't even have time to call for help. The boy flashed a shiny black object in my face. The sudden pain in my eyes was so intense, so sharp, I thought I'd die. It was like nothing I'd ever felt before. I couldn't hear or see or feel anything except that throbbing, searing fire centered in my eyes. I heard myself cry out as I let go of everything to clutch my face. Someone grabbed me by my ponytail and pulled me along very fast, so fast I didn't have time to resist. The pain of being dragged along by my hair was almost as intense as that in my eyes. Hands grabbed my wrist and pried my hands from my face, compelling me to bend over. Then cold, cold liquid was splashed in my eyes. The water felt so good. My God, thank you. The pain was subsiding. Easy, girl, easy. You're gonna be fine. It was Danny's voice, his hands holding my head and dousing my eyes with water. "I can't see," I whispered. "I can't see." "Hold on. You will." Over and over again, The cold water flooded my face. Some of it went into my nose and down the front of my blouse. Bit by bit, I could see the sleeve of Danny's uniform, see the water, see the floor beneath us. The awful pain in my eyes had turned into a bearable sting. My eyes felt dry, as though there were a film drawn tight over them. "What was that?"
"I don't know," Danny said. "Maybe some kind of alkaline or acid. The few drops that got on your blouse faded the color immediately. Hey, let's get you to the office so we can report this. You gotta get to a doctor."
"No.
No,"
I protested.
"Why not?"
"School's almost over. I want to go home right now. Please, please don't make me."
I felt tears.
I knew he hated me to cry, but the thought of going to the office made me crazy. I couldn't handle having some hostile clerk telling me I was making mountains out of molehills.
"Calm down. You can do what you want, but..."
"No. Home, right now," I said, cutting Danny off.
A short time later, an optometrist examined my eyes and studied the spots on my blouse. He put some kind of soothing substance into my eyes and covered them with eye patches. As I sat there in the dark, I heard him say,
"Whoever kept that water going in her eyes saved the quality of her sight, if not her sight itself. She'll have to wear the patch overnight. She'll have to be medicated for a while. She'll need to wear glasses for all close work. I'd really like to see her wear them all the time. I'll need to see her once a week until we're certain she's all right."
Glasses. All the time, I thought. No boy wants to date a girl with glasses. Despite the doctor's instructions to wear an eye patch for 24 hours, I had to take it off. I couldn't let the reporters see me with the patch because they would ask questions and make a big deal of it. By the time we got home, it was 7 o'clock, and I wasn't very talkative for the waiting reporters. Once inside, I fell into bed, too exhausted to eat dinner.
"Thank you, God," I whispered.
"Thank you for saving my eyes. God bless Danny always."
The hanging, stabbing, and burning of a Negro effigy near Central High. Arkansas Gazette, Friday, October 4th, 1957. The newspaper story contained several vivid pictures of Central High students gathered the day before, hanging the effigy, then burning it. They were smiling gleefully as though they were attending a festive party.
"You made it. It's Friday," Danny said, greeting me at the front of Central once more. "Your peepers okay?"
My eyes still felt very dry and tight. There were floating spots before them, but I could see. They only stung when I went too long without putting the drops in. Later that afternoon, there was a movie star, someone I'd never heard of, speaking before a pep rally. Julie Adams, a former student. She was there to boost spirits because, she said, Central High School's reputation was being tainted. Over the weekend of October 5th, a great thing happened that took the Little Rock School integration from the front pages of the national news. The Russians launched their 184-pound satellite, Sputnik. But as the next week began, local radio, television, and newspapers claimed that 101st Guards were following us females to the lavatory and harassing white girls. GIs in girls' dressing rooms, Forbes says, ran as a banner headline in the Gazette for Monday, October 7th. Of course, it wasn't true. However, it made the military tighten up rules about where soldiers could or could not go with us and prompted them to launch a massive internal investigation. I could see a steady erosion in the quality of security in response to charges of interference by the soldiers. It was evident, as the early days of October passed,
that whenever the 101st troops relaxed their guard or were not clearly visible, we were in great danger. 17. Faubus wants school respite, still says Negroes must be withdrawn. Arkansas Gazette, Thursday, October 10th, 1957. The governor continued to conduct a public campaign, complaining loud and long in a nonstop series of newspaper, radio, and television interviews that integration must be halted. Inspired by his attitude, those who did not want us at Central High were digging in their heels and becoming much better organized in their efforts to get rid of us. Each day we arrived to find we were facing a different set of circumstances. Officials experimented with ways of protecting our safety that would at the same time please politicians who wanted the troops gone from school and gone from Little Rock. Increasing physical violence brought back the 101st Guards on some occasions. We found ourselves spending our days with one personal bodyguard from the 101st, or with varying numbers and kinds of bodyguards, or totally alone. For example, when one of us had a major problem, they brought in a 300-pound 101st guard nicknamed Goggles. With nightsticks and other equipment strapped at his side, he made the kind of shield that fended off even the most hardcore segregationists. We grew to love him because being with Goggles meant a safe day no matter where you went. God bless Goggles and keep him in good health forever, was my prayer. The beginning of the second week of October brought with it the realization that I would have to settle into some kind of routine that would allow me to cope with day-to-day harassment. Beyond the noise and hoopla of integrating school, beyond the glitter of news conferences, beyond anything else going on in my life, I had to figure out how to make it through 7 hours with Central High segregationists each day. My diary entry for Tuesday, October 8th, read, "The ride to school today seemed livelier than ever. The driver of the Jeep was friendlier. He finds all this confusion quite amusing. I like what I wore, my orange blouse and quilted skirt. On my way to the third period class, someone squirted ink on my blouse. I went to class feeling hurt and angry because I knew it would never come out. In English class, a boy was called on to recite. When he failed to answer the question, I raised my hand to recite. When I gave the right answer, he said, 'Are you gonna believe me or that nigger?'" 2 days later, on Thursday, October 10th, I wrote, "This morning I was given 2 new guards. This made me feel quite uncomfortable. I left home without eating breakfast, and gee, was I hungry. But I couldn't go to lunch in the cafeteria because that room is becoming the main place for them to get me." On some days, I found myself thinking, every waking moment, about nothing else but my safety, consumed with learning skills that would keep me alive. When would someone get the best of me, and how could I head them off? By October 11th, I had made myself ill with what appeared to be flu, but was probably greatly compounded by a real case of fear and exhaustion. On that Friday, I stayed home from Central and snuggled down into my bed, where it was safe. I was well aware that my illness was more sadness and exhaustion than flu. I knew I had to get myself together because the next day I was supposed to meet with some of the 8 others and some hardcore segregationist student leaders for a discussion that might lead to an understanding. To ensure my speedy recovery, Grandma came after me with castor oil. I protested, but I knew it was no use. I had tried to explain to her that I was just weary of hostile white students, hurtful deeds, soldiers and army jeeps back and forth to school, and news reporters with their endless questions. Weary had always been an older person's complaint, but I knew for certain I was weary. Grandma was having none of it.
The orange juice will cut the taste. Here, drink, she said, leaning in so close that I had no prayer of escape. Don't make me bend over this way. My back hurts. Her spectacles slid to the end of her nose. I looked into her huge, determined eyes, and I knew I was trapped. I gulped it down. The warm, oily liquid was oozing across my tongue, down my throat, when she popped a peppermint drop into my mouth. And it wasn't only the castor oil I had to endure with my claim of flu. That was just the beginning of a whole official ceremony that included Grandma's garlic and herb poultice on my chest, which I figured was guaranteed to asphyxiate the germs. If that didn't do it, the inch-thick Vicks salve she smeared over every centimeter of my body would surely send the flu bugs running. Yet as awful as some of her healing treatment was to endure, it felt better to be there at home with her than at Central High. It's too bad you have to miss a day of school. Mother Lois fluffed my pillows and tightened the sheet at the bottom of my bed. Dressed in her tan gabardine teaching suit with black blouse, she was off to school. Hope you'll be able to attend the meeting tomorrow. She leaned over to kiss my forehead and to fetch her briefcase from the chair where she had left it. Meeting with those Central High kids could be a first step to some kind of peacemaking. I knew very well I would have to force myself to attend. It would be the first time ever that segregationist student leaders would be coming to talk to us integrating students in a reasonable, safe place where we all could speak our minds. It was sponsored by a Norwegian reporter, Mrs. Joram Ricketts, who had set it up with Ernie, Minnie Jean, and me, and the group spotlighted as staunch troublemakers, Sammy Dean Parker, Kay Bacon, and their crowd. Sammy Dean Parker had been seen in the newspaper embracing Governor Faubus as she thanked him for keeping us out of school. People referred to the meeting as a possible turning point, a time of coming together. I had thought about nothing else for several days. I even dreamed that we would go to the meeting and afterward things would calm down considerably at school. After a real heart-to-heart, the white students would see the light, and that would be the beginning of a smooth year. It was that hope that made me drag myself out of bed on Saturday morning and head for the parish hall of St. Andrew's Cathedral. Upon arrival, I learned the meeting would be recorded by the National Broadcasting Company for future use on a network radio show. I hope that wouldn't change our being able to speak our minds. The meeting room was a stark white setting with mahogany straight-back chairs. It was the kind of place that could well inspire a deep, honest talk that might help us get along with each other. Mrs. Ricketts, a woman of medium stature with blonde hair, pulled to the nape of her neck, began asking questions. Joseph Fox, labeled a central moderate because he didn't violently oppose our presence, said, I lay the whole blame for this thing in Governor Faubus's lap. We wouldn't have had nearly so much trouble if he hadn't called out the National Guard. That's not so. I think our governor is trying to protect all of us, said Sammy Dean Parker, an avowed segregationist seen embracing the governor on the front page of the newspaper. He's trying to prepare us. He said we'd have to integrate, but he has to prepare us. Ernie said, All we want is an education and to be able to go to school and back home safely. When Mrs. Ricketts asked why some of the white children objected to going to school with us, Sammy Dean replied, Well, it's racial, marrying each other. School isn't a marriage bureau, Ernie said. We don't have to socialize, I said. Kay Bacon said she had heard rumors that we wanted to rule over them. I don't think you know much about our people. I don't think you ever tried to find out, Minnie Jean said. Kay admitted she hadn't tried to understand much about us until that meeting. We're scared to death 500 of you all are gonna be coming into school, Sammy Dean said.
The white students also expressed their feelings about the troops. Several times they spoke of their outrage at having soldiers in their school. "How do you think we like being escorted in and out of school?" I said. "How do you think we like not knowing who will hit us and when or where we'll be attacked?" Later in the New York Times, Sammy Dean Parker and Kay Bacon said that as a result of the meeting, they now had a new attitude. One headline in the Gazette read, "Two pupils tell of change in attitude on segregation." Sammy Dean Parker was quoted as saying, "The Negro students don't want to go to school with us any more than we want to go with them. If you really talk with them, you see their side of it. I think the NAACP is paying them to go." When I read her statement, I realized Sammy hadn't understood at all our reason for attending Central High. I wondered where on earth she thought there was enough money to pay for such brutal days as I was enduring. I wouldn't know how much money to charge for all the good days I wasn't having in my old high school with friends who liked me. What price could anyone set for the joy and laughter and peace of mind I had given up? I stayed in bed all day Sunday, telling myself I was ill. But the truth was I was partially suffering from downhearted blues. That meeting hadn't helped the integration at all. Those white students didn't understand. Even when Vince called for our regular Sunday date, I didn't give up my claim of illness. Snuggling down into the safety of my bed made me feel as though I were a carefree little girl who hadn't been to Central High and hadn't yet discovered that miracles don't happen exactly when and how you want them to. In my diary, I wrote, October 14th, Monday. Flu, absent. Governor Faubus is still speaking out and causing turmoil. Quotes in daily papers make me know he will not let us rest. Today, Mother Lois brought home a new hi-fi. I guess she thought it would cheer up my sadness. October 15th, Tuesday. Flu. Absent. With my head under the cover so grandmother could not hear or see me, I cried myself to sleep. I know I am fighting for a good cause, and I know if I trust God, I shouldn't cry. I will keep going, but will it really make a difference? I feel like something inside me has gone away. I am like a rag doll with no stuffing. I am growing up too fast. I'm not ready to go back to Central and be a warrior just yet. I don't have any more strength. I want to stay right here, listening to Nat King Cole. On Tuesday, October 15th, my friends entered Central with only one soldier from the 101st as an escort. Once inside the school, only 21 National Guardsmen and 9 101st Airborne soldiers guarded them in the hallways. A story in the Wednesday Arkansas Gazette was headlined, "Two Negroes Ill." I thought it was funny to read about myself and Terry Roberts being out of Central High with the flu. By the time the paper printed the story, I was already back in class. According to that same article, Terry had said that things had been so bad for him the week before that he had almost decided to quit Central and go back to Horace Mann. By the time I returned to school on Wednesday, things had deteriorated. The headlines that day read, 101st Division cut back force today, half going back to Kentucky. Until that time, when soldiers were taken away, it was only to Camp Robinson, a stone's throw away. The announcement of their departure to Kentucky gave segregationists reason to celebrate, and it was evident in the students who bragged about their renewed hope of getting rid of us. As I stepped into the hallway, just for an instant, the thought of fewer troops terrified me. But the warrior growing inside me squared my shoulders and put my mind on alert to do whatever was necessary to survive. I tried hard to remember everything Danny had taught me. I discovered I wasn't frightened in the old way anymore. Instead, I felt my body muscles turn steely and my mind strain to focus. I had to take care of myself. I could really depend only on myself for protection. A new voice in my head spoke to me with military-like discipline. Discover ink sprayed on the contents of your locker. Don't fret about it. Deal with it. Get another locker assigned. Find new books. Get going. Don't waste time brooding or taking the hurt so deep inside. Kicked in the shin, tripped on the marble floor. Assess the damage and do whatever is necessary to remain mobile. Move out. Warriors keep moving. They don't stop to lick their wounds or cry. During early morning classes that day, several students heckled me about Minnie Jean, saying that if she tried to take part in their school activities, there would be a big retaliation. Word had gotten around school and to the Central High Mothers League that Minnie Jean would be participating in a student talent show. Segregationists demanded that we not be allowed to participate in any extracurricular activities. That nigger ain't gonna sing on our stage. My daddy says he'll see her dead first. The boy shouting this ran past me, knocking my books out of my arms. When I bent over to pick them up, someone kicked me from behind and pushed me over. I landed hard on my wrist. It felt broken. Okay, get yourself up and I'll get the books. It was a voice I didn't recognize, speaking to me while students rushed past, laughing and pointing as I lay in pain. An Arkansas National Guard soldier was standing beside me, gathering my books and speaking in a gentle tone. Can you get up? Try to get up on your feet as fast as you can. I tried to get to my feet, but my head was pounding and my body ached. What the hell? Gal, take my hand. You're gonna get us both killed if you don't move. We ain't got no help. He took my hand and boosted me upright. It hurt to stand on my ankle. Let's move out of here, right now. He was pushing me faster than my body wanted to go, but I knew he was right. I had to move. When we finally got to a safe spot, I thanked him, blinking back hot tears. That soldier, whoever he was, stayed within full sight of me for the rest of the day. He didn't say anything, but whenever I looked for him, he was there. As I was leaving school, he was standing in the hallway, slouching against the wall like his buddies. But he had been kind to me, and I would remember that not all members of the Arkansas National Guard were of the same character. That evening, during the meeting at Mrs. Bates' house, we were told that within a few days we would no longer have the jeep and station wagon to take us back and forth to school. We would have to set up carpools. I tossed and turned all night, wondering whether or not we could survive without our 101st Guards and the station wagon escort. By mid-October, there were fewer and fewer 101st Guards and fewer Arkansas National Guardsmen. We quickly learned that the presence of the 101st had lulled us into a false sense of security. The segregationist students were just biding their time until they could make their move. As the guards were reduced in number, our attackers revved up a full campaign against us. The less visible the 101st, the more we suffered physical and verbal abuse. Judge Davies dismisses suit for removal of U.S. troops. State may file, Forbes says. Arkansas Gazette, Friday, October 18, 1957. That lawsuit had been filed by Margaret Jackson and the Central High Mothers League. Segregationists continued to apply whatever pressure they could to get the troops reduced. Governor Forbes continued to bargain with President Eisenhower for our withdrawal from school and for an extension to begin integration sometime in the far distant future. Forbes's declarations provided a glimmer of hope that made segregationists feel their oats. We were suffering increased harassment inside the hallways and classrooms, and still, the troops were dwindling day by day. Although I saw some 101st soldiers around the school, Danny didn't seem to be there any longer. At first, I looked for him in every corner. But finally, I was so busy defending myself that looking for him was no longer the first thing on my mind. In the days that followed, I neither understood nor controlled the warrior growing inside me. I couldn't even talk to Grandma India about the way I was feeling. It was a secret. As Samson had been weakened by a haircut, I thought I might lose my power if I spoke of it. I stopped complaining as much to my 8 friends about the awful things segregationists were doing to me. I stopped trying to figure out what might happen the next moment, the next hour, the next day, and focus intensely on right now. I thought a lot about how to appear as strong as I could as I walked the halls, how not to wince or frown when somebody hit me or kicked me in the shin. I practiced quieting fear as quickly as I could. When a passerby called me nigger or lashed out at me using nasty words, I worked at not letting my heart feel sad because they didn't like me. I began to see that to allow their words to pierce my soul was to do exactly what they wanted. My conversations with my 8 friends began to change too. We joked less with each other, and there was considerably less talk about our hopes that the students might immediately begin to accept us. Instead, we exchanged information about how to cope. Don't go down this hallway to get to the cafeteria. That's where the hit-and-run trippers wait for you. Stay out of the 3rd-floor doorway. Boys with knives hang out there. Don't exit that set of stairs. That's where the boys with the dynamite sticks always wait. It was the kind of information warriors exchanged to wage the battles they must win or die. My energies were devoted to one goal, planning for my own safety and shielding myself from hurt. Even though I wasn't totally satisfied with the grades on my report card of October 17th, I decided I had to make staying alive my priority. October 20's newspaper carried an article saying that Clarence Laws, Southwest Regional Field Secretary for the NAACP, denied rumors that we 9 were being paid to go to Central or had been imported from the North to integrate Little Rock schools or that our parents were planning to take us out of school. On October 23rd, we left school without a guard and walked to the station wagon alone. On the morning of October 24th, we walked to the front door once more without an escort. The evening headlines read, Negro students enter school without escort, reduced to 6 101 airborne. My brother, Conrad, complained that I wouldn't play games with him, not even our favorite Monopoly. I realized he was right. Lately, I had no time for play. Vince was complaining as well because I wasn't available to speak on the phone or to go out with him. My after-school time was filled with meetings and news people, and sometimes just sitting silent in my room to ponder what would become of me. Central High integration was slowly destroying my life. During one late October after-school meeting, we discussed the fact that President Eisenhower would not stop withdrawing 101st troops even though our parents and Mrs. Bates had sent a telegram informing him that opposition against us was more violent with each passing day. We discussed trying yet another approach to change the attitudes of school officials so they would take control of the hooligans. The next day was a living hell. In addition to increased heckling in the hallways, it was the beginning of a series of experiences in my gym class I would not soon forget. It all started with a verbal barrage I tried to ignore. You're already black meat, and what is black meat? It's burned meat, said the lanky brunette with a devilish gleam in her eyes as she stood outside my shower space. I stood, stark naked, my privacy invaded while others joined her, leering and spouting insults. I was racking my brain, wondering what she was talking about, and then it came, the scalding water. I felt myself cry aloud as the sheet of steaming water spread pain across my shoulders and back. I was stunned, paralyzed by the cruelty of their act. Two other girls appeared just at that moment to shove me directly beneath the spray and hold me there. I suddenly felt surging inside of me a strength that matched my determination. I grabbed my attacker's arms and pulled them in with me as close as I could. I let them feel my anger with my elbows, my feet, and with words that would take me to brimstone and hellfire later, but at least I'd have time to prepare. I was using some of the same language they used on me. As the girls backed away, I emerged to find they had removed my clothing and books. There I was, scrambling about wearing only a towel and a bad attitude. When finally I found my outer clothing, it was stuffed in a corner, but my underwear was on the floor of another shower, soaking wet. I would freeze all day. I could look forward to damp spots seeping through to my outer garments. As I got dressed, my clothes irritated my scalded skin. It hurt to move. Later in the day, I encountered the heel-walking committee. Groups of students would walk close up behind me and step on my heels, generating the most excruciating pain. I would walk faster, but they would catch up and continue doing it. After a while, my heels were bleeding through my socks. When I went to the office for Band-Aids, the woman on duty turned up her nose and sneered. "If you can't stand an occasional tap on the heel, why don't you leave?" By the end of the day, I was exhausted from defending myself and trying to figure out what would come next, and I was beginning to have an uncontrollable urge to fight back. On Monday, October 28th, Mrs. Huckabee notified us in writing that we were to contact our parents to come to a meeting in School Superintendent Blossom's office downtown at 4:45 p.m. That last-minute request meant Mother Lois had to rush over from her teaching job in North Little Rock. But it was necessary because we all hoped that meeting would signal the beginning of the school officials' willingness to do something about the incredible increase in attacks against us. I couldn't imagine what else they'd want to discuss. 18. As we climbed the stairs with our parents to the meeting in Superintendent Blossom's office, it was clear that we all had one thing on our minds, that school officials provide a concrete plan to stop the abuse by Central High's hardcore segregationist students. "I'm angry enough to hunt bear without my shotgun," said one of the fathers. "These folks had best do something really big to show me they want to make this integration work." "I'm tired of them counting on us to make all the sacrifices," said another parent. "We need to know what they're willing to sacrifice." 30 minutes into that meeting, neither Blossom nor any of his people had addressed the issue we had told him we were anxious to discuss. Instead, all the school officials present were giving us the same song and dance about our not responding to our attackers in order to maintain peace. They were lecturing us on the proper attitude and the responsibility of our parents. There were no words from them about how they were going to take responsibility for keeping students from abusing us. "Excuse me," Mother Lois said, suddenly rising to her feet, interrupting Superintendent Blossom mid-sentence. I was frightened to see her standing there, so tiny, wringing her hands nervously. "What I want to know is whether or not you have any specific plans for protecting our children."
"That's none of your business," Blossom replied in a rude tone.
"Oh, I'd say it's very much my business." Mother's words came rapid fire. Still, he ignored her, continuing his rhetoric as before. Silence fell over the room. She interrupted him once more. "As parents, we have a right to know how you will protect our children." He gave her neither an answer nor any acknowledgement that she had a right to ask such a question. Instead, he continued his meaningless comments
ignoring her as she stood there for several minutes expecting him to answer her. Finally, she took her seat. Her face was red with anger and embarrassment. I felt that by disrespecting Mother that way, the superintendent was disrespecting all of us seated in that room. I was very angry with the others, especially the fathers who did not stand up and defend my mother. The humiliation and fear I felt so upset me that I couldn't consider anything that was said during the remainder of the meeting. Nevertheless, it was clear by the time we left for home that nothing had been resolved. 9 Negro students enter Central at different door. Arkansas Gazette, Thursday, October 31st, 1957. On Wednesday, with no sign of our military escorts, we decided to avoid the hecklers who were starting to greet us each morning. We arrived early and entered the 14th and Park Street entrance, a block to the right of the front entry. We had determined that going in the front door presented more risks than it was worth. The repeated recitation by Governor Faubus that our voluntary withdrawal and the departure of all troops was the only way to bring peace was reflected by a change in the students' attitudes. It was as though they counted on our getting kicked out at any moment. Those few who had earlier tried to reach out had obviously been pressured to turn away. One girl who happened to meet me alone in a restroom said that she and the other moderate white students were being harassed with telephone threats and were being ostracized. It was evident that school officials and teachers were under more and more pressure from segregationists to help them get rid of us. For me, the most frightening events at school were the increased number of pep rallies and assemblies that came with the football season and the beginning of the holidays. At those times, I was surrounded by a sea of hostile faces and a chorus of hurtful words. There weren't enough teachers or guards on earth to corral the out-of-control students. We came to refer to the auditorium as the torture chamber. I had grown to expect being elbowed, poked, and kicked, to have my hair pulled, to be punched in the back or trampled as I was entering or leaving the auditorium. But having glue doused on the back of my neck and in my ponytail was more unpleasant. I was at first paralyzed by the terror I felt when during one assembly a boy thrust a knife at me. As I sat in a shadowy corner beneath the balcony overhang, he placed the blade against the side of my face and whispered obscene threats. I surprised myself by biting down hard on his wrist and then springing up out of my seat to find a teacher, but she wouldn't listen to my complaint. "Both of you sit down right now. You're disturbing the others," she hissed, directing me back to my seat and returning her attention to the stage. No sooner had she turned to leave when out of the corner of my eye I saw the flash of the steel blade as the boy thrust it at me once again. Only this time he gripped me even tighter. I felt the sharp blade shave the side of my cheek. No matter how I struggled, I couldn't break his hold. Once again, I bit down as hard as I could into his forearm, drawing blood. He quickly pulled back his arm, muffling his outcry. "A rabies shot! I need a rabies shot now!" he growled at me. The teacher listened impatiently to my second report and then said, "These children have tolerated a lot of upheaval." Even though she ignored me, I felt better because at least I wasn't a whining wimp anymore. Alderman orders arrest of NAACP officials. Arkansas Gazette, Friday, November 1st, 1957. The adults we counted on were showing ever more stress. Mrs. Bates' newspaper was being strangled economically. At the same time, she and other NAACP officials across the state were under increased pressure from State Attorney General Bruce Bennett to turn over all records, including names, addresses, and phone numbers of members and contributors to the organization. Bennett had, a few months before in August, filed a civil suit against the NAACP, saying the organization had been doing business in Arkansas for 7 years, although it had only recently registered as a foreign corporation. He had early on begun to badger Mrs. Bates for information about all the members and contributors of the state's 27 branches. It frightened us to see our allies being abused. In my diary, I wrote, "What will become of us if the NAACP is not strong? It feels as though segregationists are attacking from all sides. They know very well we count on Mrs. Bates and the local NAACP people, as well as Mr. Marshall. If they're busy defending themselves, who will see after us?" During those first days of November, we found ourselves coping with yet another crisis brought on by insensitive Central High School officials. The Tiger was their school mascot, and the Tiger Directory was a list of all the students' names, addresses, and telephone numbers. Despite our requests that our names and numbers not be listed, and despite the fact that school officials had overwhelming evidence that our lives were in jeopardy, our information was nevertheless included. Yes, newspapers had printed the information before, but they had stopped. This new release summoned into action passive students who might up until then have thought twice about calling us. So, of course, we got more and more phone calls, whether they were threats and vicious language or mere hang-ups. Those calls took our time and energy. I continued to yearn for the return of the 101st full-time. We were told that a couple of hundred soldiers remained at nearby Camp Robinson. Somehow, I figured that maybe, since things were so bad, they would come back to be with us every day, guarding us up close as they had in the beginning. But it wasn't happening. The next time I saw Danny, he said he didn't think he would return on a regular basis because the powers that be wanted us to stand alone. Those times when we were lucky enough to get our 101st Guards were wonderful. We treasured their presence, as infrequent as it had become. Sometimes we were guarded by the Arkansas National Slobs, as we called the federalized soldiers, who, by then, had shown us in every way that they loathed the responsibility and didn't take it seriously. They had become visibly hostile toward us, sometimes whispering threats and taunting and teasing us when they got us alone. Segregationists were publicly urging them to abandon their duty stations rather than guard us. On one of the first days of November, Minnie Jean arrived at my house after school to show me Life magazine. It had a full-page picture of my back in it. There I was, ponytail and all, saluting the flag. It wasn't the first time we'd seen ourselves in print or on television, but we giggled at the wonder of it all. Miss Minnie Jean and Miss Melba could now be seen on the pages of Life, Look, or the New York Times. We did, however, begin to notice there was a price to be paid whenever we appeared in periodicals or on television. The next day, the harassment inside Central would always increase. As Minnie Jean and I spent time together that evening, I could tell she was beginning to be deeply affected by what was being done to her at Central High. She seemed especially vulnerable to the isolation we were all struggling to cope with. She had decided she would be accepted by white students if she could just show them how beautifully she sang. She was almost obsessed with finding an opportunity to perform her music on stage. She said she was definitely going to participate in a school program and had, in fact, already made inquiries about it. Little did we know that even while we were discussing her performing in school programs, the Central High Mothers League was preparing to make a bigger fuss than ever before to exclude her. With each passing day, the furor about her wanting to participate was building. But their threats did not stop Minnie Jean. She was already waging yet another campaign to sing on stage. This time it was to sing Tammy in the talent show. It was as though these objections fueled her need to do what wasn't wanted. I wondered whether or not she had considered that the audience would boo her off the stage. Did she figure they would be enraptured by her performance? I shuddered at the thought of what the students would say or do to her if she made it. But I could tell that her anxiety over the constant abuse we endured and the sadness over being left out was clouding her view. She delighted in planning for the performance, announcing and displaying a joyful glee about the possibility of singing in front of the white kids. When I talked to Ernie about my concerns, he brushed them aside. As usual, he was taking the situation in stride. Even when he was punched with punishing blows or was kicked to the floor, he kept a positive attitude. I liked his attitude, even when I didn't agree with his view. Like me, Thelma was very concerned about Minnie Jean. We talked about how we could convince her to stop pushing to participate. Each of us was hearing increasingly negative responses to her desire to do so. It was clear to us that both students and outsiders would take the opportunity to make a huge issue of her request. Terry was philosophical about it. Let her try and she'll learn her lesson once and for all. I could see Terry becoming more fatalistic about our predicament. His hopes that we could change people's minds were visibly reduced. He was nervous, not as cheerful, not humming his funny tunes. Stress was beginning to tell on Gloria, too. She was clamming up, becoming solemn. I could almost see her mind working to try to set things right so she could keep going in her meticulous way. Elizabeth had never fully regained her composure following her awful encounter with the mob. Continued harassment was also taking its toll of her. She reacted by becoming silent and withdrawn. When I discussed Minnie Jean's predicament with Elizabeth, she appeared alarmed and agreed that we ought not attract unnecessary attention to ourselves. Carlotta strained to keep smiling. Although she often took a lot of heat, especially in gym class, she tried to make the best of it, as did Jeff. Like the two other boys, Jeff was taking a lot of brutal physical punishment. He was quick on his feet, but he often got trapped in gym class or in corners of the hall where he was kicked and punched. Whenever we compared notes, we all agreed. The students' attitudes had become polarized. We felt it would be best for Minnie Jean to back off, but none of us could talk her out of it. She was adamant. The more we pleaded, the more determined she seemed to become. Only during fleeting moments did I allow myself to have fantasies of what it might be like to sing with the chorus or perform in the Thanksgiving program. My hopes of being a part of normal activities had long since faded. I refused to set myself up for disappointment. I simply wanted to make it through the year alive and uninjured. I resigned myself to devoting all my energy to that goal. I was surprised when I was invited to speak to the students who attended chapel, a fairly safe corner of the school. It had been the one place where I had found brief moments of peace on those days when I arrived early enough to go there. I agonized over the invitation, but finally Grandma made it easy for me. "This is your opportunity to witness." "But what if they throw things?" "In the house of the Lord? Surely not. These white folks aren't heathens. While you speak, they will come to understand you are all worshiping the same Lord." So I prepared my talk, but I kept my invitation to myself. I didn't want to hurt Minnie Jean's feelings, given the heroic effort she was making to convince school officials to allow her to sing on stage. Army has orders to remove troops of 101st at school. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, November 19, 1957. The 101st Airborne Troops were going back to Kentucky. My heart pounded as I raced through the article that told
how Major General Edwin Walker, head of the Arkansas Military District, would head the force of about 225 men from the Arkansas National Guard. They would take full responsibility